Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, my name is Don Smith, the founder of the Blog Talk Radio. Good evening and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. I'm your show host, Scott Jackson, and today I'll be speaking with Amy Caraballo. And Amy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Scott. Thank you very much for having me on.
You're welcome. Thank you. How do you pronounce your last name?
Caraballo, basically.
Caraballo, okay. Okay. I probably won't be using it much since it's a tongue twister, but
not a problem.
But I'll just refer you as Amy, if that's okay.
That's perfectly fine.
Tonight we're speaking with Amy because she's the mother of a now 10-year-old boy who has Asperger's syndrome. Although this account was nearly 5 years ago, Amy's more interested in just bringing it to the front to help others, like I'm sure you've heard by now, Tina O'Banion and her 6-year-old son, who are going through much of the same thing at present. At the time, nearly 5 years ago, Amy said that she was completely unaware that her son was being physically abused and was only told a year later when the school was being investigated and researched to that case. The behavior of the school staff soon turned from neglectful and dismissive to abusive. And while seclusion and restraint can be used in a classroom in special circumstances, my screen is jumping here. As I'm trying to read. To prevent a child from causing immediate harm to himself or others. Now, reports show that incidents of abuse go unmonitored and unreported, though throughout most of the country on a daily basis. That's not unlike much of what our school systems all over the United States are like at present. And Tina's just going to share with us, speaking with Amy this evening. I'm just going to ask Amy just to share a brief history of her account with the school and abuse, neglect, or mistreatment. Amy?
Yeah, thank you, Scott. And basically what Scott was reading there was an article that was sort of published about our story a little bit anonymously. When my son first entered the school district, we immediately started having problems with him pre-kindergarten. He had started a summer program in which was supposed to help prepare kindergartners who might have some transitional issues into transitioning. Now, from an academic standpoint, he was actually more than ready to go. But we were concerned because he had already been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome at age 4. Then we knew that he had transitional issues, that it might be good for him just to get familiarized with the school district and the building and the area in which he would be attending kindergarten. Go ahead.
No, I was just responding, exactly.
Yeah, no problem. And so basically what had happened was right away the teacher who was teaching the summer program was very, very negative and would approach us every day and say, you know, he's just not doing well. His behavior is out of control. And at the time we were kind of caught off guard because we had already prepared the school to know his diagnosis. He had actually transitioned out of early intervention services with an IEP, and she was getting upset with him for behaviors that were part of his disability, which were, you know, hand flapping and sometimes talking out of turn and having trouble keeping his hands to himself, very indicative of his diagnosis. And
right.
at the time in Pennsylvania where we live, we have this program that's informally known as wraparound. And so we had a person who was going to this classroom with him, and she was reporting back to us that the teacher was just targeting him and a couple of other kids in the classroom who were a little bit more, you know, rambunctious than the others, and really unfairly disciplining. A couple times she tried to segregate him away from peers during activities, sort of to try to teach him a lesson. And so right away we thought, oh my goodness, you know, this is a kindergarten teacher. But she actually took medical leave, and so some preschool teachers had come in and taken over for her, which actually turned out to be okay, and so life went on. When we started kindergarten, his teacher was really wonderful, but there was no supports in place for him. We found out that when they transitioned him out of early intervention, they didn't give him an IEP, although they told us that we did. It was just a technicality. They were trying to sort of... Their basic mentality in the end, what we found, is that they really didn't feel like Asperger's is a real diagnosis, or it wasn't a valid one for our son anyway. And so therefore, they were just trying to appease us and let us think that, yeah, he's going to get services. So in the end, we started fighting before he even entered the building, because we found out about 2 weeks before kindergarten that he didn't have anything in place. So and after struggling with summer kindergarten, we thought, this isn't going to be good.
Mm.
So as time went on, you know, the teacher was very, very patient and very, very nice to work with. We also still had this one-on-one with him that was going, you know, privately on our behalf through the state's program, who was reporting back to me that the principal was following our son around and sort of like an intimidation thing. And she would come home and tell us that, you know, she was intimidated and she didn't understand, but it almost seemed like they were targeting him. Suddenly, I was getting phone calls, and this is like 2 weeks into school, that he had to go home. He had to come home. You come pick him up. We can't deal with him. His behavior is out of control. Come get him. So after a while, we thought, this is ridiculous. You know, are you using, you know, all these strategies that we talked about, and they, you know, were giving us all sorts of trouble, you know, oh, well, of course we are. And then we would find out from our one-on-one that they were not. So finally, we realized that, you know, we were probably going to be headed to due process. But we've hired an advocate. We paid an advocate to come out of one of the local cities, and, you know, nearly what it would cost for an attorney, we paid for a paid advocate to come. She came in, and they looked at our records first and told us, even after the school had given us a paper document and had an IEP meeting, that we didn't have a legal IEP because there was never an evaluation to show his needs. So we just had paper. So that's why they weren't following it, because they didn't have to. Yeah. So in the end, the advocate came to the IEP meetings. We got an evaluation, but we knew, we saw what they were trying to do. So we had retained an attorney just to keep things in check, to make sure that, you know, they weren't doing anything else. Towards the end of the school year, things got a little bit better, because the teacher really kind of saw that the school didn't maybe have our son's best interest at heart, and she got a little fed up with some of the mandates, which apparently one of them was every time our son left the classroom for even a sensory break or a walk or a class, you know, sip at the water fountain, that the principal was to be called so he could come down and oversee it. So that was going on for some time, unbeknownst to us, and then apparently the teacher got a little fed up with it too, and so they started to kind of circumvent the principal and were doing their own thing, and he had a successful rest of the year. So over the summer, they, of course, didn't offer him any type of extended year program, even though he probably really needed it for the social aspect of it. We just had to fight even to get them to allow him to have, you know, a sensory break in his IEP. So we weren't ready to fight that. So over the summer, we didn't really know what would happen, but a couple weeks before school started, we found out that this one-on-one that had been working so wonderfully with him was pulled off of our case 2 weeks before first grade. And, after a couple of meetings and some research, we came to find out that the school had something to do with that. So we kind of realized they were trying to get rid of any type of supports and help that he had so that they could kind of figure out their agenda, which we felt at that point was to make.
Figure out their own agenda.
Yeah, they were working on trying to get him placed in some sort of self-contained classroom somewhere, which they didn't have really any availability at that point. So I think they were biding their time until there was a classroom that they thought they could dump him in rather than have to support him. So we started to kind of realize how they work. But anyway, long story shorter, we hired somebody. Again, we went to a new agency after we found out that that agency apparently had a lot of unethical relationships with the districts. Two different agencies who then we had hoped would be a little bit more helpful. They were less liked by the district. However, they weren't completely forthcoming with us about everything that was going on. The school, in the meantime, had put an aide in place. You know, we thought a paraprofessional, but it turned out she was just a teacher's aide with no background, no training, nothing. She was a parent who needed some part-time work. So they put her with him, and they apparently made our therapeutic person, who did have a degree and, you know, specialized in special needs kids, she was just backup, and she wasn't allowed to do anything. And we were getting little bits and pieces from her and her boss about how things were kind of strange at school. And we just were seeing our son's behavior get worse and worse and worse at home. And we were starting to see this happy-go-lucky, I love school, I love to learn child turn into a dark, dark child who just really at one point told us he wanted to die. And he was 6 years old. So, he had that October or November, he ended up in a mental health facility because he was talking about wanting to die and wanting to kill himself. And he was also having very, very heavy behaviors that were, you know, very severe at home, where he was a danger to himself and possibly us. So as he was an inpatient, they said, oh, we don't really understand why he's here, because he's just like a breath of fresh air. And we thought, yeah, but, you know, when he's at school, you know, so of course they give you the same song and dance. Well, you know, maybe you need to hire advocates and, you know, so we've been there, done that. So by this time, we knew where we were headed. So we had been meeting with the attorney about filing due process. After we found out that they were restraining him and putting him in the seclusion room, he finally mentioned it. And so I questioned his one-on-one. And his one-on-one said, well, they take him to that room sometimes when his safe room, which was supposed to be a place where he could go, where there was soft lighting and beanbag chairs and nice music for him to decompress, when it was unavailable, they would take him to this emotional support timeout room, they called it. And, you know, our concern was, well, why wasn't this room available to him? And, you know, and it turned out it was just purposely not available. So he apparently was going to this room, and at this point we didn't know of it happening frequently. We knew that it happened a couple times, and we knew that restraints took place while he was in that room. And we could never quite get to the bottom of why the restraints took place in that room, because he was in a room with nothing in it. It was just a small room with a couple of doors that were closed and pads on the floor, and that was it. So we're not exactly sure, you know, at that point, why would he need to be restrained in there? We thought maybe somebody's confused.
Excuse me, for a second.
Yeah.
Amy,
so,
was there a lock on the outside of that door or on the inside?
To this day, I still don't know, because I've never seen it. That was one of the other issues. The school district prohibited us from visiting anywhere in that school building. We couldn't go when he was in there, when he wasn't. Could go to public thing. So, because in kindergarten, when things were going so terribly, I had offered to even, you know, go in and sit in class and see if I could help, you know, let me see if I can point out, you know, see what's going on that might be setting him off so we can, you know, but I wasn't allowed. So what had happened is our attorney sent a fax to the school and said, you know, you must stop restraining right now. And as soon as that happened, it kicked up tenfold. And at the time, of course, we still didn't know this, but he finally, as we were still waiting for things, this is right around, it was right around Christmas break of first grade, he had been getting a bath, and I noticed he had some bruises on him, and I said to him, I said, oh, you're as klutzy as your mother. Look at you with all the bruises. And he says, oh, those aren't from me. Those are from my aide, which was the teacher's assistant. And I said, huh? You know? And so I got him out of the bathtub, and I came up to my husband. I said, oh, my gosh, he just said this. And so we started, you know, grilling him, and he's looking at us like, what are you guys doing, you know? But it was, show us what you're talking about. And so he was showing us the restraint that was being used on him. And it was a prone restraint with two adults sitting on him with his face down on the floor. Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. So we basically pretty much lost our minds on that, and after we found that out, he did not go back. Then we you know, got the attorney to get the ball rolling a little quicker, and really we weren't sure what we were doing. I had sent the school letter and said, you know, we were not going to be sending him back until they were able to provide him with a proper education. But in the meantime, we realized that we couldn't really send him back, so we unenrolled him from the district and enrolled him in a cyber charter school. And so at that point when we did that, suddenly the people that were working for us started to talk. And then now that they didn't have to go back into the school, they told us stories that we had no idea had been going on. And this had been going on all of the school year. He had spent almost every day of first grade in that seclusion room. And generally what would happen is he would be escorted, quote-unquote, from his classroom for things such as simple as banging on his desk out of frustration because he got stuck on a math problem. And instead of redirecting him and trying to help calm him down, he'd be told he had to leave then. And then if he escalated anymore, they would evacuate his classroom. So apparently they had the peers actually being nasty to him at this point because they were all like, you're the bad kid, you know, we have to leave class because of you. And then he would become very upset, and then he would become, you know, probably a little out of control. So they would drag him all the way across to this other side of the school building where this room was and put him in the room, close the door, and leave it open a crack. And they would watch him through the crack. And if he didn't calm down in enough time, the principal would come down. Sometimes the district administrator would come down, and they would go in and restrain him in the seclusion room as a disciplinary method.
In the seclusion room?
Yeah. Where he wasn't a danger to anybody. He was just being belligerent at this point.
Right.
You know, darned if you do, darned if you don't. So he was at that point. And so basically they'd sit on him until he said uncle. And then he would be made to stay there for at least another hour. And then at times they would let her go back to class, but it would just repeat. It was rinse and repeat all afternoon because by the time, you know, he really wasn't allowed to make a slight move out of the ordinary and he would be back there. So that was going on. You know, we were very, very glad to have gotten him out of there. And then the school district, what was interesting, wasn't documenting any of this. So if you were to pull my son's educational record, it would look like this never happened.
Nothing has happened, right.
Yeah, because, you know, if we don't document the restraints, then the restraints never happen.
That's right.
So thankfully we were able, you know, and I think probably because the people that we had in there were afraid they might get in trouble now that they hadn't been reporting to us like they should have been, had offered to testify against the school district in court. So at our settlement meeting, I'll never forget the district administrator's face when our attorney said to her, you need to tell me, she said something along the lines of, oh, we've tried to work with these parents and they just turn away from us every time we try to help. And I said, is that what you call it when you send my kid to a seclusion room every day and put him in a prone restraint while he's in a room by himself? And she said, well, what would you have us do? And her attorney's jaw dropped and hit the floor, I think, because to that point, she hadn't been admitting that that had happened. And so right away, the attorney was like, what can we do to fix this? And I said, turn back the clock, you know? So, yeah. Suffice it to say that, you know, we were lucky that we had somebody in there who witnessed this who would be willing to stand up against the district. for whatever reason. But, you know, there are hundreds of parents that have no idea what their kids do while they're in school every day. And we have no rights as parents, although on the paper and in the books we do, it's a lot different in implementation. And, you know, I guess my story is a warning to parents who have special needs kids in schools, especially those that might have some disruptive behavior, whether it be purposeful or not. You don't know what they're doing, and you need to know what they're doing. And you need to know that you have the rights to go into that school district, and we need to really work as advocates to make sure that these laws are implemented, because they're as good as the paper they're written on until they're implemented. So anyway, just to add to the story, like you said, it's been 5 years since this all happened. He's now a fourth grader, and he's been attending his cyber charter school, which is just amazing. They have absolutely been the complete and total polar opposite of what we experienced in the public brick-and-mortar school. That my child has more supports than he ever had. We have therapists that come to the home and work with him. We have extended school year services for social skills to help him with peers. It's just amazing. They actually did a behavior intervention plan for us, which is, you know, really ironic, because we couldn't get one at the local district who was having all these behaviors. And now he's sort of in a homeschool atmosphere, and they're trying to help me as much as they possibly can. So it's just been amazing. But he's, over the past few years, really started to despise school. Now, when we first pulled him out, it was like this big relief for him. Academically, his IQ is off the chart. He's brilliant. He picks up and retains facts and math and things like that very, very quickly. So sometimes he's teaching me. As a matter of fact, today he was teaching me geometry. So I don't have a problem there. And so we were really struggling as to what it was about, because you're so brilliant. And once you do the work, you're so quick at it, you can get through school in a few hours in a day. You know, it's amazing. And so we just weren't really sure. But behaviors were getting worse and worse and worse. And he was starting to become almost homicidal with us, and suicidal again. He was talking about wishing he was dead. He was going to kill himself. It got to the point where we had to lock up the knives in the house. And we were just at a loss. So finally, it's been almost a year ago now, spring, we put him in an inpatient again, because we were really concerned. Some of the behaviors were getting worse. And finally, somebody sat down and listened to our story at the hospital that we took him to at this point, and they said, we think your son has post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, it hit home, because I had started to suspect it a little bit, because I always thought of the stereotype of the Vietnam veteran who hears a car backfire and goes into this hypervigilant state.
Right.
And that was our son. All of a sudden, he was worried about everybody out to get him. He started to have this almost paranoia that people were, you know, that he couldn't trust anybody anymore. He was constantly afraid. You know, he couldn't walk across a parking lot at age 9 without thinking he was going to get hit by a car. Just things that never happened within his life. In his whole life, he had not had this severe anxiety. So when they diagnosed him with that, they sent us to a special place, a specialized hospital, who it's called the Center for Traumatic Stress, and they only deal with children. You know, we kind of felt like, oh, they're going to turn us away, because these are people that are dealing with kids who have gone through sexual abuse, serious violent, you know, family abuse. But we got there, and they evaluated it, and they said, absolutely, he's a candidate. So he's been in the program now for, I'd say, about 4 months. We go weekly, and he sees a therapist, and he's telling his story, masks through sort of, sort of fantasy. His family are insects, one of his special interests. But he's telling his story sort of as a public service announcement, so that other kids don't have to go through this. And just as a matter of fact, last Friday I got to read a little bit of it, and let me tell you, it's gut-wrenching, and I learned new things that I didn't know just from the story that he's told so far. So he's getting better. We're seeing a lot of improvement in his behaviors. He doesn't have the homicidal, suicidal stuff going on. Now our big struggle is avoidance with doing anything pertaining to schoolwork. If I gave this kid an encyclopedia and I said, go have at it, it has nothing to do with school, he'd probably read the entire encyclopedia and spit it back to me. But if it's something he has to do that is something expected by his school, I can't get him to do it. So, you know, we're still struggling with that.
Yes. I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about the prone restraint here. I know I just posted a few links to the chat room, which is helpful, and I usually have a Word document on the side so I can copy and paste, and that'll be available to anybody as well. So it's interesting where I've gone thus far, Amy, is I actually went to the first place in one of the first sites in the Google search engine. It's horrible. It talks about how it prone restraint does not cause, restraint asphyxiation, and that's just untrue. And when, in fact, it's just the opposite of that. And, in fact, I'm just going to read one little segment just to help people out there that may be listening that don't know about prone restraint. Protection and Advocacy Incorporated, I'll call them PAI, they've investigated a number of deaths or serious injuries sustained while the victim was restrained face down, or otherwise known as prone, which you say your son was prone.
Right.
PAI's medical expert had concluded that those deaths or injuries were most likely caused by the positional asphyxiation, and specifically now, the prone restraint position. So in years ago, I guess people used to call it hog tying, and that's pretty much what it is. PAI releases a report as part of its ongoing educational efforts to improve the safety of people with disabilities, to publicize the hazards of prone restraint, which thank God they do, because very few people actually do that, right?
Right.
Encourage healthcare professionals to eliminate the use of prone restraint, and they minimize the prone containment. And then they also discuss the paradigm shift from viewing restraint and containment as a treatment intervention to a treatment failure. So, it's good that there are people out there like this, but there needs to be a voice within inside our schools. Now, I know you were just talking about, from what I've gathered so far from what you've been saying, is in the beginning, with this other school, not the school that he's in now, that he had all these, all these restraints and seclusion room and what have you, that in the beginning there, that people weren't even allowing you to be part of his life in the classroom. And pulling, just even classic abuse, what some of the signs there are, when you think of just, I say just, but I'm an abuse survivor too, by the way. When you think of just, take the word just out of it, because abuse is wrong no matter which way you look at it. In your son's case there, and in Tino Banyan's son's case, I can see this. It's so negative. See, the teachers weren't even allowing you to be present, eliminating the need for them to, to keep a close eye out. Why? Why?
Yeah.
Because obviously they had something to hide.
Exactly. And after our case, I've been very vocal from a local perspective about our story. I was very careful in the settlement agreement. My husband and I scoured it several times and had the attorney make changes because we did not want a gag order. We wanted to be able to tell our story and let people know this is going on in your town. And I'll have to tell you, people look at me cross-eyed, and they still do locally sometimes, because nobody wants to fathom that people who go into the business to teach children could do this kind of stuff. But, what I will say about it is it's systemic, and it's not just our area, and it's because of a global mentality. And the mentality is that, first of all, throw everything about, public schools being, a not-for-profit business. They are for profit, even if they're legally not. It's about bottom lines and what can we do to keep the most money in our districts. And in Pennsylvania, there's a kickback system going on between these specialized setup intermediate units who are supposed to be supporting school districts with special education services and training and things like that. And instead what they've done, they get these huge grants from the state every year, and they go and set up segregated placements. And then they set up these classrooms that are their classrooms for special needs kids. And so they have autism classrooms, and they have multiple disability classrooms, and they have emotional support classrooms, and life skills classrooms. And so then they go to these districts, and they say, hey, do you want to put your kids in our class? And the districts will say, well, heck yeah, but we don't want to pay you tuition for it, because they would have to. But what happens is the intermediate units say, well, that's okay. You pay us tuition, and then we'll pay you rent, and it'll be a nice wash. And so what happens is the state money gets funneled to the districts, and they all make money. So, the Arc of Pennsylvania uncovered that a couple years ago and has a standing position paper that says that the intermediate units should lose all funding because of this, and that, you know, the extra funding should move directly to the districts to create better inclusive programs, because it's just bad. So what happens is when you get a kid who is considered quote-unquote high-functioning, which I really don't like the term because to me it's misrepresentative, but if you have a child who looks like they can pass for what is neurotypical from appearance, they try to just put them into a sink or swim program. And then and then they don't have to spend the money. They get the money, but they don't have to spend it.
That's right.
They give them minimal, as was our case. You know, they gave them an itinerant teacher who came in once a week for an hour and checked in to see how things were going. But there was nobody there on site to help him to model his, to look at his program and to keep tweaking it until it was something that worked for him. Or they find one of these segregated placements and they dump these children into these classrooms where there is a one-on-one for every kid, and probably a teacher and a teacher's aide, and none of these kids are learning a darn thing. You know, you walk into one of these classrooms, and it's kids spinning out of control because there's just no structure. So that's what normally happens. So when you get a case like ours where our son does need support, he's not one of these introverted Asperger's kids. He's an extroverted, which is probably not as typical. So, but both of his parents are very extroverted, so he has learned to be so. And so when he gets upset, he lets you know right away. He doesn't bottle, which, in a way, I'm kind of glad, because sometimes I think that's even worse. But he can't pass off as a kid that they could just put in the back of the corner and not do anything with. And, you know, if he becomes crazy when he's, 15 because he's been bullied for the past 20 years, well, then we'll deal with him then. So my kid's going to stand up for himself, and he's going to say things, and so they don't know what to do with him, because now they either have to support him or they got to get rid of him. So their agenda, basically, from my perspective, was that, you know, if you can sit here quietly and be a round peg like the rest of the students, you can be here. But if you're going to be a square peg, then you got to go. So that's... And, you know, I've talked to other parents, and like I said, I've been very vocal locally, and it's systemic really badly in our county, where if your child really is in a district program and he's included, he's not really getting included. He's getting excluded because he's getting disciplined and he's getting, you know, he's held to a different standard. And if he's, in most cases, if he has some, behaviors, then they're going to try to push them off into one of these segregated, self-contained programs.
Right.
Now, with the parental restraint, I will tell you this. At the time when he was still in school, Pennsylvania did not have any laws on the books about restraint at all. They do now. I was actually working with the Arc of Pennsylvania's Education Committee at the time, and so I was very vocal about it. And the Value Coalition of Pennsylvania had gotten involved, and so they did manage to get a blurb into the Pennsylvania regulations for special education that prone restraint was now illegal. By this time, he was not in the district any longer. However, my concern has been this, and it's still this, even if and when the federal legislation passes. Who is there to monitor these schools to make sure they're still not doing it? Because as with our case, it wasn't getting documented. So if nobody's there to tattle, it didn't happen. And like I said, we were lucky that we had somebody who was willing to talk, whether it was because they were worried about their own behinds or because they really cared is irrelevant. But, you know, not every parent has that. And there's a push now in our area to sort of change the program so that the schools themselves sort of employ these therapeutic people. So it's going to get worse before it gets better, as far as I'm concerned, because when the schools are the ones actually overseeing the program, there's not going to be anyone who's going to be on the family side.
That's right.
So, yeah. So, I mean, honestly, you know, the use of restraint and the excuse that I've heard for the prone restraint specifically is because they don't want to get spit on, which just makes me laugh. I think to myself, are you kidding me? I mean, most of you people are parents, and how much baby drool have you, dried off yourself? And you're really worried about a five-year-old kindergartner spitting on you? We're not dealing with, you know, kids who have severe, you know, again, I don't know. I'm trying to think AIDS isn't even spreadable by saliva. I'm trying to think of something you can get, you know, botulism or something. I don't know. But, you know, really, it's about respect. It's about they don't want to be disrespected. And so, therefore, they're trying to teach these kids that if they act up, they're going to be treated this way. It's a disciplinary method. It has nothing to do with protecting anybody.
That's right. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Amy, I'm just doing a brief, a little bit of sensory overload here for me.
No problem. But,
I know all too well.
Well, I have ADHD, so if I see a bunny run by, you better watch out.
Well, I'm so thankful for you piping up here tonight in this chat, in this radio segment and chat room, because this info needs to go out there. This is widespread across the world. Now, people don't understand. I'm just looking from my point of view here, Amy. I'm looking at just type in, you know, in a Google search engine, and you will find all these different uses of prone restraint that I'm thankful I know just from viewing, I guess in Ohio they passed it just this past, you know, well, will be this past month, March of 2010, they passed it to ban the use of prone restraint. Two teachers from Ocean View School in Southern California, they used a technique called the prone restraint on a 7-year-old boy with autism and severe disabilities on September 6th of 2007.
Uh-huh.
The student suffered bruises, scratches, and a broken nose, according to MSNBC. Now, the student, who does not speak, was throwing classroom items, hitting and running, when the teacher and assistant teacher used the prone restraint to calm the student. To calm the student now. The two teachers held the child's leg and arm while the student was face down on the floor, and the school report said prone restraint, which means the person is held face down. And it's and the teacher said that it's rarely used, and it's usually the last resort to control a child, experts say.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, unquote, control a child.
Yeah, well, again, it depends on what your control means.
Control here. Because, you know, I've been in facilities, and I've worked in facilities, actually, with severely MR adults, okay, and they will, most of the people that I've seen, okay, will be self-injurious and not injurious to other people. Maybe, perhaps, if they were too close, they might get injured. But that's when you need to learn to back away. Now, in the case of your son and Tino Banyan's son as well, I mean, in this just so many cases around the world, I mean, can't you see that as probably one of the best methods is to back off?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as with the case, you know, and let's presume that this is a child who's really being violent, like, say, a child who's throwing something. You know, you do have to watch the other kids, obviously, and you have to watch yourself, especially if they're throwing desks or something along those lines. But putting hands on them you know, and let's just look at it from the autism perspective. My son's a proprioceptive craver, which means he likes to be touched. He likes to be touched
right.
deeply. A restraint for him could be therapeutically inviting. It's not any longer, but at one time in his life it may have been, so we don't know if that's why it all went terribly wrong or not. But, yeah, I mean, you back off and you don't lecture the child because I forget who it was that said this. I've read so many different books, but somebody called it vapor lock. And I thought that was just such a perfect explanation of the explosive behavior. He's in vapor lock. You're talking like one of the Peanuts characters' parents right now. He's not understanding anything you're saying. You need to be quiet and calm, and you need to not throw more attention to it, because if it is an attention-seeking behavior, if you feed attention to it, you're going to encourage it. So, you know, I would love to have been a fly on the wall, because I would have loved to have seen where it all went terribly wrong initially. My guess would be that it may have initially have been a child who got frustrated with something and learned that how to get away from frustrating situations was to misbehave, which would get him away from anxious situations. And so he learned that, you know, to use this behavior for his own good, and then it, you know, backfired on him. But he was 5, so I can't really expect him to be able to foresee that far in the future.
Right. You know, schools have changed over the years, but for the worse. I mean, even when I was in school, I can recall, and my mom recalls as well, when I was just in either third or fourth grade, you know, I was a very... Much like your child, I was, you know, very anxious all the time, needed to be moving all the time. And I'm an extrovert as well. In the classroom, just fidgeting, you know, wiggling back and forth, it was viewed by my teacher as disruptive to her classroom. And I'm talking, you know, this is 30-some-odd years ago. So, you know...
how far we haven't gone. You know, it's sad that we're still at that place.
Maybe, and perhaps they were, you know, I know they used rulers back then and, you know, or spanking and set you in a corner somewhere, you know, to isolate you. But things have certainly waxed worse over the years as they're now, you know, restraining and Amy, do you recall what type of restraining technique that these teachers were supposedly trained upon, or were they even trained?
I do have to say his teachers actually were never involved. This was always administration and the teacher's aide. But they were supposedly trained by our intermediate unit, but they were never. It was never divulged to us as to what type of restraint they were trained in. We did, as a family, go and learn about a restraint method that was a prone restraint method that we still disagreed with, and that was one that one of our the agency that was working with him at the time, he was in the district, the aide that, or the person that we had the one-on-one with him to the state, they were trained in. However, they were not allowed to use it unless he was really severely going to hurt himself or someone else, you know, and they used that as, you know, clear and present danger where, you know, serious bodily harm kind of stuff, and they weren't allowed to use it, and if they did use it, they had to file all sorts of incident reports, and they didn't really want to have to do that, and they were smart enough to know that they could just back off and he would calm down and life would go on, but anyway, like I said, I don't really think... My understanding, and to this day, a lot of it's speculation on my part as to, you know, what else happened, because I know of certain incidences, and as he grows older, he's told me more things, and every once in a while he confides and tells me a story, something new that I didn't know. There was a lot of emotional abuse going on as well, things being said to him like, you know, you shouldn't listen to your parents because they don't know what they're talking about, and you should be ashamed of yourself, you're a bad kid, you're never going to have any friends, and this is by adults. So so anyway, you know, and of course the school was saying they weren't restraining even though they were, and so that's another reason I'm sure they weren't real quick to tell us about the fact that, you know, they were... trained in anything, but one of the other things I did want to mention, because I keep it keeps sidetracking me. I keep thinking about it when you talk about how serious prone restraint can be and the positional asphyxiation. Our son has asthma on top of all this. So, when we first found out, I thought I was going to have a heart attack, because I thought, oh, my gosh, here's our kid. And thankfully, by the time he was five, his asthma was controlled. But prior to that, we went through all sorts of craziness trying to get his asthma under control, hospital every other weekend kind of stuff, crazy. And I thought to myself, my God, we are lucky he is alive. We really are, because how many times he's been put in that position. And, my understanding of his prone wasn't the hog tie where they had his hands behind his back. They had his hands over his head. So one adult would sit up on his upper back while another one held his legs down. And so they would hold his arms over his head and somebody would sit on the back of his legs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
From what I understand, that's not a legal restraint anywhere, but it was whatever they wanted to do.
Like I said when I was talking with Tino Abanian yesterday or the day before, she was talking about, I was talking to her about how law enforcement agents aren't even using it. It's so wrong on so many different levels.
Yeah.
Now, I know we've talked about prone restraint, and you've talked about how your son was bruised. I mean, you could see it when he in the bath or whatever. Had you it must have been highly suspected, even before that. Before the bruises appeared, you had some red flags go up. Can you just mention maybe a few of those red flags?
Well, the red flags were definitely that, the school district was fighting us on allowing us to visit the classroom. And we had no contact with our teachers, whereas parents had parent conferences. We never had parent conferences. So we had a whole different thing going on. So we knew, like I said, at the end of kindergarten that we were struggling with a district that was problematic. And so we had retained the attorney to try to get some advice and guidance, figuring we probably were going to end up in due process, but we really tried to stick it out. 2020 hindsight would not have stuck it out so long had we known. But the red flags, my concerns really were about how his behavior was deteriorating at home. When we first got his diagnosis, he was 4 years old, and prior to that, we were butting our heads into the wall, trying to figure out what was the problem, where he was having behaviors that were very indicative of the terrible twos at age three. And we knew how smart he was, and he was verbal, but not conversationally verbal. And we were just really trying to figure him out. And we finally got, because we were already in the Children's Hospital Network for asthma and things, we got referred to the developmental pediatrician, who at the time didn't even diagnose him, but she wanted to watch him. And pretty soon thereafter, we got the diagnosis, and everything clicked. We were like, okay, we know exactly what we're dealing with now. This is perfect. And, we learned everything we could about it, and we started to, realize how much maybe his dad might be in the spectrum-ish area. And so we were like, okay, we understand all this. Now we know what to do. We can throw all these, parenting your children from birth to age five out the door and get the Asperger's parents books out. And things started to be great. Preschool was going well. Things were just really good. And then all of a sudden we send him to the public school system, and we watch our child from a happy, couldn't wait to go to kindergarten, so excited. And we look back now at his school pictures, and we just think to ourselves, how did we not see this? I mean, just see his face melting away, where he's just not a happy child. And we saw the behaviors at home as such, and that's when we were starting to say, what is going on there that is causing this child to feel so bad? And, of course, everybody's saying, oh, well, he needs a med, or he needs this. And nobody ever really wants to think that this kind of stuff is happening in the schools. And like I said, it took us nearly 5 years to get him diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which really has been his problem. His Asperger's is fine. He does great. He's a wonderful kid. He, like I said, he educates me every day, and he's just great. But this, dark side of him, which now is from the trauma, is what has been holding him back. And, that's been our struggle.
Right. I do have a couple people in the chat room, and one's trying to chime in here.
Okay.
I do have a few problems with that. There are some some pretty vulgar words being used here. So for that reason, I'd appreciate it if they'd stop using the vulgar in the chat room. I do understand that people are abused on so many different levels and ways, and we'd like to help, but I just don't see the chat going in entering this conversation, Amy. And I do apologize, but we need to keep it a little bit on a moderated level. Thank you.
Not a problem.
Amy, how's your son now?
He's doing so much better. He is a lot more pleasant. He still is struggling with the whole "I deserved it" stuff. So we're working on that with the therapist now. He's at least able to tell his story now, which for a couple of years, which this is when I started to suspect this was more than just a child who's learned a bad coping skill, which is what we thought for a while, when he started to deny that anything bad ever happened to him at the school. And we were kind of like, well, you remember they were restraining you? And he said, yeah, no, I don't think so. And I thought, okay. now he's at the point where he is remembering it. He described it as being something he put in the back of his brain, and it's locked away in the chest, and he doesn't want to open the chest because he doesn't want to see what was in there. It was kind of like a puzzle coming together, and he did not want to see what the puzzle was going to look like when it was done. But his therapist has gotten past that point now, and they've talked about a good part of everything that's gone on and things that were said to him and how people mistreated him and why that was so wrong on so many levels. But now he's still at that state where, yeah, but you know what? I really am a bad kid. So we're really working on that now.
Well, good, good. Your school support now for your son, obviously they've gotten much better. You're seeing quite an improvement in your son as well. In helping other parents, Amy, you've been through it, and I know that we can help Tina in this aspect as well as many others. How do you see Tina's son in relation to your son? I know it must be quite difficult for both of you to see your child abused and to see all these bruises on him and wonder why, and then all these, you know, and that alone being so traumatic. But how can we help Tina, Amy? I know you have a website available. If you could go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I know right now Tina's struggling, financially, trying to afford her attorney representation. That in itself is a huge problem. We were lucky that our attorney took a retainer, which was, it was significant, but we got that back after due process as part of our settlement. We had it. We struggled. We found it. We got it at the time we were able to do it. But there's a lot of parents who don't have that kind of money. So a lot of advocates have gotten together, and we set up a PayPal account that you can donate to help defray some costs for Tina, because Tina's a single mom and just doesn't have the funds available to her in any form. And I also, on the side, sell Avon, and they have a fundraising capability now. So I did set up a website that you can actually purchase if you already buy Avon products or not, and you just need some shampoo or something, that you could actually visit the site, and 10% of your order fees will go to Tina's attorney account, which is also be deposited into the PayPal account that's going to go directly to her attorney.
Great. Great. And I do know that that website is up and running. I know a few people that have donated thus far, and that's going to be helpful. And we appreciate what Amy's done here as well, out of the goodness of her heart. And thank you so much, Amy. Amy, we have, I am going to allow the chatter in. He is decided that he is going to be better. If I hear anything out of the unordinary, I will certainly silence immediately, okay? But there is a question for you on the chat line, and I'm going to be allowing in TommyB464. TommyB464, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Tommy. Do you have a question for Amy?
Yes. My question actually was, did you say that your son was abused at his school?
Amy?
Scott?
I'm sorry. Amy? Amy?
Hi.
Hello?
I think she got dropped.
Hang on just a second. I'm trying, Tom.
Yeah, no,
Amy,
no worries, mate.
Hello?
Amy?
Yeah, can
you're
you hear me now?
There? Yes,
can
I'm sorry.
I don't know what happened. All of a sudden I got static on my line and then I was gone. And I was like, oh, okay. So I called back in, but then I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me. Sorry. And yes, in answer to your question, yes, this did happen at his public school in kindergarten and first grade. Mostly what we know is from first grade. We do think kindergarten was a little bit better because the person we had that was going in as his one-on-one with him was working sort of for us. And she was pretty good at telling us what was going on. So it was in first grade for about a half a year that this went on.
Right. What sort of abuse was he actually, like, being... What sort of abuse was being used on him? Was it, like, physical or mental or...
It was both. It was both. Basically, a lot of emotional abuse where they were telling him he was a bad kid and, you know, he should be ashamed. You're not going to have any friends if you act like this. But what really was probably...
Whoa, she got caught off there, Tommy.
Right, okay.
Yeah. I think... Try and I'll see her. If she comes back on, I'll certainly allow her back in. Tommy, I think her son was abused in the way of restraints. When they were restraining him, prone position in the school system using the prone restraint, he was bruised. And of course, okay, Tina's here again. Sorry, Tina. Amy.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was trying to figure out how to keep this going. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry, I don't know how much you heard of that, but primarily he was being put in seclusion, and while he was in there, there were two adults sitting on him in a prone restraint with his face down, sitting on his back, basically trying to teach him a lesson.
That's disgraceful.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And it went on, you know, I guess, you know, and this is all based on what I was told after the fact, you know, possibly, you know, a good percentage of every day of his school day for the, you know, time he was there. And that would have been from August till December.
Right, okay. I must say that's quite bad because, I mean, obviously, a lot of kids today get abused by the students. But by the sounds, this is a bit of a severe case that it was actually the teachers and the helpers that were more picking on him.
Yeah, and actually, it was administrators, which makes it even worse. It was a principal who certainly should have known a lot better. But they had an agenda, which was to either, you know, sort of scare the autism out of him or perhaps get us to take him out of school, which inevitably we did.
Yeah, that was probably the best. The one question is, was your son a sledge bagger? And
okay, I just, I kind of knew that was going to come there, too.
I didn't hear what it was, and I'm kind of glad.
Yes. I cut him right off, sure. And I'm hanging him up.
Alrighty.
Right now. Okay.
No problem. That's the internet.
Okay. We're going towards the end anyway of the program.
Okay.
But I do want to continue this, but I'm going to put on my moderation back in the chat room so he can't have anything to say there.
Okay.
Yes, I'm very glad you didn't hear that. But I'm very glad I allowed him in for a question and you had the chance to answer. Yay!
Yay!
That's what moderation's all about, right?
There you go.
See, I'm so leery about chatters and gentlemen. But
yeah.
Amy, as we end here, I'd just like to say thank you so much for coming on the show tonight and to it must have been hard reliving your story, but I think it's very important that we all understand how important this is for to advocate in our schools for all our children to be part of that legislative process. No matter how hard it is, there are still our children and they need our help. And all across the nation, this is happening. It's not just happening in Pennsylvania. It's not just happening in Arkansas. And it's not just it's happening all over the world. And we just want to call attention to this evening and call attention to it every year until it stopped. And obviously, it's not going to stop unless we speak up, such as Amy just has. Amy, thank you so much for joining us on the program this evening.
Not at all.
And thank you so much for your story. And Tina O'Banion and her son, we're thinking of you. And kudos to your son, too, Amy. I'm glad to see he's getting the help that he needs and the help that he deserves. And with
thank you.
I'll say you have a good night. And
thank
may
you.
God bless. Thank you.
Take care. Thank you so much, God. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.